This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your vocally impaired leader here, Chris Spangle. How are you doing, everybody? Across the table from me is Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Chris. How are you?
And joining us is one of my favorite people, a total badass, Melissa Hubbard. How are you doing?
Awesome.
I almost always use the D word, in Melissa D, instead of Hubbard.
Well,
it's quite the shift.
Yeah, Melissa Hubbard. I took my grandmother's maiden name.
Yeah, and you're going to want to talk right into that mic for me.
I'm talking right into the mic.
There you go. So I must have a summer cold of some sort because I woke up from my nap today, and I'm like, hi, guys. How are y'all doing?
Are you still doing the nasal spray?
Of course.
Oh, I didn't know, because, you know, like if it ran out, that could be the, you know, the cause.
It's Confessions of Dear Leader time. I'm addicted to Afrin and have been since roughly 2007. I got a cold in early 2007, thought I'd try a little Afrin, and it's all downhill from there. So, but it's the, I never was able to breathe out of my nose until then. So,
deviated septum probably.
I don't have a problem. And if any of you want to tell me I have a problem, I'm going to ignore you. Melissa is, we have known each other how long?
I believe we met in 06 when I was on Abdul's show.
It would have been 07 because I wasn't there yet. I was around, but I was a weekend producer at that time.
Oh, you were. Okay. Yeah. Well, I first went on Abdul's show, I think in January 06, and then I was on a couple times because Abdul gave me platform during the city's litigation of me for being a dominatrix.
And just then, hold on, let that sink in.
Okay.
So Melissa rose to infamy,
prominence,
infamy or fame, depending on how you view it, several years ago here in the city of Indianapolis because she ran a dominatrix business out of her home, totally, hey guys, totally legally, and was shut down by the city over time. And turn that into a very successful activism career, that's how we met when I was at WXNT. So that's what we're going to talk to Melissa a little bit about tonight. We want to focus on not only the naughty bits, but also how to make local government your bitch. It's maybe the best way to put it.
It's my specialty.
Yes. So I just recently had a fun dinner with Melissa, and we sat there for 3 hours talking about all this stuff. And I just thought, you know, we've got to, and I kept saying to Greg, it's like, we got to have Melissa on the show.
And so. I had never met her until the AFF event. And then you mentioned again that, you know, she might be interesting to have on. So I'm quite excited. Yeah. This is different than any show we've ever done. And I can't wait to do it.
So how do we begin? How do we start this? Let's see, because there's so many different pieces to this.
Has Lindsey Graham ever been a client of yours?
Well, if he was, I wouldn't remember his real name, and I would have changed it to something, you know, silly, like pigtails or something.
Right. Well, I want to focus on the government activism stuff, but you can't get to the government activism stuff without going through the BDSM stuff. So without being as, you can curse here. We're all adults listening to this podcast, so don't be afraid to say whatever you want to say.
Clearly that's never stopped you.
That hasn't. A few weeks ago, I ranted about a fake person named Aunt Donna who was jacking off youth pastors.
Associate ministers. And by fake, he made air quotes when he said that. So let's be clear.
Oh, no. You didn't.
Oh, he did. Aunt Donna.
I'm out of control.
Aunt Donna and her skill set.
So can you maybe talk a little bit about how you got into it and what is BDSM, first of all?
Well, BDSM is an acronym. It stands for bondage, discipline, sadism, and masochism. And in the middle of the BDSM acronym are two letters, the ones that are most important to me, D and S. The D is for dominance, and the S is for submission. Now, BDSM deals with the physical, spanking and bondage and stuff like that. But the dominance and submission aspect is the part that it's psychological. And that's the part that most fascinated me, is how does this psychology work? And what do you do to get a person on their knees? And why do they want to go down there? So that's the part that fascinated me, and it's where I spent most of my headspace was with the DS part of it. Now, I did BDSM, of course. I did the physical part, but that was really just to get to the psychological part.
Right. And explain what that looks like.
What do you mean, what
the
that
psychological
looks
part? What are the games that go on that your clients would ask for?
Oh my gosh, it ran the gamut. Would you like to hear about some stuff I wouldn't do?
Sure.
I would get some crazy requests. I mean, because there's some hardcore freaks out there.
Some hardcore freaks in here.
Speak for yourself.
Hey, don't look at me.
Speak for yourself.
But like a common thing that I would get requested to do that I would turn down because I thought that it was dangerous and I there was just no way I was going to accept potential liability for it. But there were guys who would offer me large amounts of money, over $1,000 sometimes, if I could kick them with boots on in the groin as hard as I could and bring them down in agony in just one kick.
Sounds like the sort of thing Mittens is involved with.
So, yeah, there was that. And then there's, are you guys familiar with what scat is?
Yes, yes. Let's make this brief.
Yeah, well, with scat, anyone out there listening just needs to Google it real fast because I don't want to go into it, but there are...
Yeah. There you go.
That sums it up.
And there are people that, you know, are obviously into that. And it is dangerous edge play. And I would not do that. And it was kind of easy for me to stay kind of on the more tame side of, you know, of this role play because I dealt with a lot of novices.
Right. Right.
So, you know, my job was to give them, you know, most of my clients kind of an introductory into it, you know, teach them some simple protocol things, how to kneel, get them used to taking orders and being polite and keeping their hands behind their backs. And
mostly men.
Oh, yeah. But I would get requests from women, but I turned them down because I just didn't want to do that with women. It was just more enjoyable for me to do it with men.
Right.
Man hater. Understandable.
Yeah. Well, not exactly. But
so what would you say that the typical psychological makeup of somebody that would come in for your services, who is attracted to this? Other than Greg.
Yeah, well, there's no typical psychological makeup. And the thing is, these guys are everywhere. And I promise you, look through your Facebook feeds right now, your friend feeds, because I promise you there is a percentage of people in there that do BDSM. They are everywhere. And they could be, you know, your most buttoned up person that you'd never expect in the world. It could be your, you know, friendly neighborhood politician, even.
Usually is.
Right.
Yeah, there are some of them out there.
Did you ever have any prominent local government officials come in and serve at your pleasure?
I will say this much, and no more. But there were individuals that had powerful people like the governor in their cell phone.
Okay.
Do you have the governor in your cell phone, Chris?
I do. I've got all kinds of fun people. I've got the governor, Ron Paul.
The Ronimal.
I do, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, you have Ron Paul?
Noam Chomsky.
That's... And I will say this, Ron Paul never came to me for a session.
There you go. That would be quite stunning.
So record is clear on Ron Paul. People.
Oh, good old, but Rand, that kid's a freak.
And Rupert never did either.
Okay, good.
Excellent. Yeah.
So what is the What are the games that are played? What are some of the things that you did do in this business that, you know, is it, I think maybe let's ask this question first. The perception is that it's a sexual gratification. It is, somebody is coming there for prostitution. They're coming there for sex and release. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah. A great many of them were, you know, I would always state my rules on my website, of course. And most DOMs do this. They have rules and they're stated on their website. I don't know how seriously all DOMs take their rules. But for me, if I put something, especially in writing, I own it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a person of honor and I honor my contracts. And I believe that your word is your honor and it's all you have.
Right.
So, if in order for me to do sex for hire, I would have had to have been submissive to my client and their money, and that would mean that I wasn't a real dominatrix.
Right.
So I was just never going to go down that path. Most of the sex seekers, I was able to easily screen out on the phone.
Right.
And
what would they say on the phone? Hi, my name is Greg Lenz. I'm.
How fast can I be there?
Yeah. Well, you know, they would talk about it, you know, in BDSM language and in I don't know. It would just become apparent. They would talk about, you know, wanting oral gratification and that kind of thing. I'm like, it just wasn't going to happen. And if they were nice about it, I would be nice to them. But if they were creepy, I would get pretty, you know, like I'd come down on them. I'm like, how dare you
right.
put me in this position, you little filthy slave. You know, you want me to be submissive to you? Well, I'm not going to break the law for you. And I would just kind of yell at them on the phone. And it's interesting because in 2003, I was outed to Channel 6 News by these women on the internet who kind of had it out for me.
Mock and Daisy.
Mock and Daisy. Actually, I changed their names in the book. Even though they outed me, I would not out them. And I changed their names in my book. And that whole drama plays out. But long story short, It did cause a police investigation on my practice. So the cops were calling me all the time, trying to, you know, hook up prostitution. And they would get this, like, me yelling at them on the phone and telling them, how dare they? And so the cops just sort of back then, they just shrugged their shoulders and go, we don't know what she's doing, but she's not breaking laws, so we can leave her alone. And in 03, when Channel 6 did this very intensely dramatic and for me painful media broadcast, sensationalized media broadcast for Sweeps Week. The cops went on record and said, you know, she's not breaking any laws and she has a legal right to do what she's doing. And although it put a whole lot of heat on me and it kind of spooked my clients for a little bit, I was like, whew, okay, I'm in the clear here. I just shut down for 6 months, did renovations on my, you know, 1920s craftsman house. That was really my first big round of renovations and just sort of shut down for renovations and then opened back up 6 months later, you know, bigger and better and more fabulous than ever.
With a fresh coat of paint on the dungeon.
Yeah, with a fresh coat of paint on the dungeon.
I've been in the dungeon, actually. I've seen where it all went down.
And so this was in Indianapolis.
This was in Indianapolis in Meridian Kessler neighborhood. And, you know, a lot of my neighbors knew what I was doing because I, you know, would freely talk with them about it. I'd have anybody over that wanted. I just never hid. I think if you hide, people think you have something to hide. And I wasn't ashamed of it. I knew that most people didn't understand it. I was horribly judged, especially in the beginning. Oh my gosh, I went through losing all my friends and, you know, being just at moments in my life doing this, I was utterly, utterly alone. But I did it because there were all of these coincidences in my life that I thought were like God's calling card, and I still believe they were, that God put me in that job and in that role so that I could learn to take control and own my power. And I did not understand that the universe was setting me up for something much, much larger than just being a dominatrix. And now, of course, years later, in retrospect, I see that. And these coincidences were so profound, and I was having multiple ones every day that I just couldn't ignore them. I had to risk losing all my friends and take the risks I did in order to do what I felt very strongly was God's calling.
And for you, it was a psychological interest, yeah?
Oh, very much so a psychological interest.
Can you talk about what you personally learned about the nature? Because I think control, obviously, is... control and submission are two very important interpersonal things. In any relationship, there's always going to be that. And I think in terms of politics, so much of the politics that we are dealing with is trying to be controlled. So can you talk a little bit about what you learned as far as human nature goes in regards to control and kind of gaining your own power and figuring out how to not be controlled, how to take control of situations? I mean, you're a very charismatic person. You're also a very tall woman.
Yeah, I'm 6 foot.
So you're not necessarily, you never were in any danger, you've told me. You never felt like there was any kind of danger. Most of these guys were, you know, weaklings.
Well, they were screened ahead of time, and I had their money ahead of time, and I charged them money ahead of time just to interview with me. And at that time, I mean, $100 was like more than it is now. And, you know, that was just the cost to talk to me to get screened for a session. So, I mean, at that point, you know, I was able to take control because I could look at their IDs, get real information on them. I had money from them. You know, I was bit by bit taking control. But this is the thing about control. Real control, guys, is the ability to give it up. Because if you don't, then control controls you. So real control is the ability to give it up. And, you know, in during those years, I only worked, you know, maybe 3 or 4 sessions a week. It wasn't like that much volume. So I had a lot of downtime. It wasn't like a real job. That's how I became a libertarian, too, because I loved what I read about the party, and I realized that they were kind of small at that time in Indy, and I'm like, well, I'm going to volunteer for them. I have all this downtime and all these mad skills, and I'm just going to call them up and volunteer. But for a lot of that period of time, when I wasn't working, I was meditating, and God was talking to me a lot. And the messages that I were receiving, well, I was really reflective about God's nature and God being my dominant and how God deals with me. And God's kind of hands off. God's kind of like, you know, I'm the dom, but you have free will. You have free will to come to me and consent to submit. And that's where it's all at, is with the consent. So, and, you know, I thought, well, if I'm going to be a dominatrix, you know, I'm going to employ these things that I'm learning from the universe or God or your creator or whatever you want to call them. And to me, God's plural, by the way. Mm-hmm. That makes me a little weird, I know. But the voice that would come to me in my mind was always plural.
Right.
That's interesting because, and that's libertarian oriented. The Frank Meyer, one of the fusionist of libertarian and back in the 50s and 60s, a libertarian and Republican at the National Review writer, he talked about all the social programs and taxation and all these different things to help the poor and help society. And the point was that if it was forced through taxation, it robs morality of it. Only consent and choice are what allow right. something to be a moral decision in order to help somebody.
Good point, Greg. And that's why free will, you know, I mean, are we all Star Trek fans to some extent here?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know how that free will is a prime directive. It is the prime directive. And, you know, to force your will on another person is immoral.
Yep. Yeah.
Now, you can make a case for why someone should submit to your ideas or your control or your dominance, but to force them into it, especially at the point of a gun, which taxation ultimately is the point of the gun, you don't pay your taxes, the guns will come.
It's not a hug.
No, it's not. And that's moral in my view.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. That's interesting.
It's not voluntary.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, voluntary right. interaction and choice.
Right.
One question I had was, when you formed, what did you do just prior to this?
I was an account executive.
Okay. And so then
Outside sales. Yeah.
Then you went into this, and when you formed your corporation, what did you put down as the service that you were providing or the industry that you were in?
arts and education, entertainment.
Which, yeah.
It's what it was. Yeah. I was teaching the art of dominance and submission, and I was teaching submissives how to submit properly.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you extract it out. I mean, and it is, in a way, it's performance art.
Yes, it very much is performance art.
And then as far as getting the word out explaining your value proposition, I'd imagine that doesn't come up at dinner parties too often.
Well, it did at dinner parties I went to, but that's because I was not cloaked and closeted with what I was doing. I made a decision early on, if I'm going to do this, I am not hiding in a closet of fear and shame. I'm going to take my lumps, I'm going to take the judgment, and I'm going to walk through it. And that's what I did. And it was not easy. Trust me, it was not easy. And I cried myself to sleep many nights.
How long had you lived in Murdy and Kessler prior to? That's a very nice neighborhood where Park Tudor's located.
3 years.
3 years. Yeah, I mean, one thing you'll notice as a theme in Melissa's life, and I don't know if she's aware of this, but it is that of almost a trailblazer, somebody who is, you know, I don't know if you'd describe yourself as a feminist, but I would say, you know, I'm going to do whatever I want, and I don't give a damn about societal roles and what anybody thinks of it. This is what I think is right. This is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to do. And it's backed by these principles and ethics. And if you have a problem with it, I'm sorry. Tough shit. And sometimes that has caused you a lot of friction in any club, group, societal role that you've been cast in.
Oh, I broke the kinky people's rules. I mean, they have their rules too. And, you know, this is how it's supposed to be. And I was just always kind of like, well, I'm the dom. Who says?
Right.
I mean, who says it has to be that way? It's my life. It's my fiefdom. And I'm not bringing anyone in here in violation of their consent. And if they want to follow me and come my way, I'm just happy to have them. And I would accept everyone.
So you filed for incorporation. And then you had some few initial clients early on, I imagine.
Yeah. And back then, I mean, it was just so easy to get clients. I mean, I ran ads in Nouveau.
Okay.
You know, and of course, everybody knew to go there if you had a weird need that it's you needed.
Yeah, it's our alternative weekly, and there's plenty of young busty models and Asians in the back of that magazine.
Right. And
well,
I
in the day, that was Craigslist or like, you know, Backpages or something like that. That's the internet had to, and you did it before the internet had proliferated.
Yeah,
completely.
There was internet. I had AOL, and so a lot of networking was done via underground AOL chat rooms. And then also there was this online domination directory, and it's still there. It's called Max Fish, and it's just state by state. It lists all the dominatrices, and I think he's submissive, and he was an early webmaster, and he's like, I'm going to do this as service to dominatrices all over America, and that way I can meet them all.
You can't be a webmaster and a dom and a sub. If you're going to be a webmaster, you have to be a dom.
Well, you can be master to some and sub to others. For instance, when I go to work, trust me, I'm the sub.
Oh, in preparation for this interview, how many times did she follow up with the two of us? And did you read that? Did you? she was.
I
making...
love it because it's so nice to have someone else that prepares.
Yeah. Shut
well,
up.
You know, I'm very serious about taking this message I have about self-actualization and how fear liberation leads to self-actualization into mainstream audiences. And I know if I'm going to work with media, whether, you know, it's podcasts or it's, you know, one day sitting on Bill Maher's show.
Right.
I need to be able to prep the host in a way that they may not have the time constraints to read my entire book. And I need to give them prep material to make it easy for them so the interview goes well.
Concise format.
So fear liberation, I think that's an important aspect for libertarians because so many libertarians are timid. They're the engineers. They're the webmasters. You know, they are not necessarily, they don't consider themselves charismatic or extroverted.
And their jobs are very important, too.
Right. So I think a lot of times when you say, go be an activist, go out and do a booth, go out and give the world's smallest political quiz, go out and canvass, run for office, put yourself out there, there's a lot of fear and anxiety that goes into that. So can you talk about our relationship with fear and how you break that and what do you mean by self-actualization?
Yeah, these are subjects I'm really good with, and thank you for asking. First of all, I had to deal with my own fear of judgment from my friends. Our biggest fear is always judgment. This is why our activists are like, oh, I can't run for office. What if I fail? What are people going to say about me? They're going to ridicule me. I'm going to have to go through, you know, this scrutiny. You know, there's all these fears. What if I'm not good enough? All of this fear. And my submissives would have that fear too. And I would teach them. This is a big thing because I would take them into a dungeon. Sometimes their sight and their ability to move would be taken away from them. And so I would take them into the dungeon, and I would they would have to trust me so much that they would let me take their mobility from them, their sight from them, inflict pain sometimes. But they had to trust me that I was walking them into their fear, and I was going to show them every single time, honey, it's just smoke. You walk through it, and on the other side, you will be stronger, and I swear to you, nothing is going to happen.
Right.
And so the more you do that, the more you walk into your fears, the stronger and stronger you become. Now, what was different between me and my submissives, I didn't have a dom to hold my hand.
No, and yours wasn't a simulation with a known endpoint.
No, it wasn't. I didn't have a dom. I did have a dom. My dom was God, who was talking in my head very seriously about these things. And I couldn't see, touch, smell,
right,
or audibly hear this, and I had to follow it. And but what I found is when I did exactly as I was told, it always worked out. And then I was given coincidences along the way. They're sort of like your little dog biscuits. Here, you're doing a good job. You know,
oh, like a reassurance.
Like a reassurance. Like every time you get a coincidence, it is a reassurance. It's God's calling card that you're on the right path. Well, when you're in a situation, and most people don't experience this, but I could have so many coincidences happening in a day, I couldn't even keep track of them. So it all led, all these coincidences happening in rapid succession kind of culminates so that you reach a point where your life is like living inside a movie, and it's bizarre.
So talk about the fear. I mean, what were some of the fears that you helped people work through?
Oh, just fear of like, what are you going to do to me? Can I trust you?
Right.
Is this going to hurt? Am I going to be harmed?
Being in control.
Yeah, not being in control. Or for my cross-dressers. And man, if you've got the cross-dresser gene, it does not go away. It's not something that can be fixed.
Boy, can I tell? I mean, really? Tell me more.
Uh-oh, I see some new memes in. In the Spangle, there's some new memes in your future.
So really it boils down to personal safety. It all comes down to, are we safe?
It does all come down to, are we safe? And, you know, for my subs, they had to trust me. And for me, I had to trust God.
Right.
And there was a point, too, in about, oh, I don't remember the exact date, but I imagine it was about 6 months before the media outing by Channel 6 in 2003. And I was in meditation, and God said to me, one day you are going to have to face off with the government. And it was a for sure thing, no doubt about it. And I freaked, and I said, I felt like Moses, you know, in the Ten Commandments. And I was like, oh, no, not me, Lord. And God looked down. And he's like, oh, yes, you. It was like, you know, you've been chosen to do this. And
you're already committed now, so there's no backing out.
I'm like, oh, no, not me. And then God said, yes, you. And don't worry. Do not fear. You know, how many times in the Bible does it say, do not fear? And God said, don't fear, because when the time comes, you will be given every single tool you need to prevail. And I had no idea what was coming. I sort of imagined at the time that, oh, one day I'll have to go to the General Assembly or something and talk with legislators about personal freedom. I had no idea it was going to play out the way that it did. But by golly, it played out exactly like God said. And Chris, you were there. Mm-hmm. You saw the tools fall from the sky every single time. We always had media right there. I mean,
I'm one of those tools.
Yeah,
you are one of those tools. And then, you know, how did we get all the TV stations and the newspaper to show up for 12 activists at Bart Peterson's house?
Right.
Like things like that.
Right.
And then, you know, like anytime I asked for something, it was just immediately there. A lot of times the tool would fall out of the sky before I knew I needed it. And remember, like Sullivan Hardware, they just paid for all those for sale by owner due to unfair taxation signs for me. I was going to buy all those signs out of my own bank account, and I just went to them and asked if they would sell the signs.
Right.
About property tax. Oh, no. They're like, we will not only sell them, we will buy them and sell them at cost and distribute them for you.
That's great.
You know, they're just like, send us over the email with the information and we'll get it done. And by golly, within 2 days, they were selling signs.
So let's go back. Let's circle back to self-actualization. What is that? And what did you see in your clients as they faced their fear of being judged, of feeling ashamed? What change did you see when they actually went through it and they faced their fear, they went through the experience, they got through it safely, and then they come out on the other side, and what does that look like?
Well, when they go through a fear experience, you don't just walk through a fear experience and come through self-actualized. In order to understand self-actualization, you need to understand the lower needs first on the Maslow chart. And everybody's, well, if you've been to college especially, excuse me. Maslow's
hierarchy of needs is basic security. It's
close. I'll explain it. Friendship. Yeah.
Let me explain it because I can do it a little faster. The bottom level need is food, clothing, shelter, and most Americans have that physical need met. However, if you think about our inner city. No, they don't. Those physical needs are very compromised. Food is compromised. Shelter is compromised. Housing, all, you know. But then the next level of needs is your safety needs. If there are bombs going off around you, you don't do anything else but make yourself safe. So you're not able to work on any other needs except safety. Now, imagine if you live in the inner city.
That trumps.
That
colors.
So they're compromised there too. Then the next level of needs is your love and belonging needs. Now, most of us have those needs met by our families. If you live in a compromised family in the inner city, those needs are sketchy at best. So that's part of the problem that we have in our inner cities is their lower needs are not met. And we ask ourselves, why do some of these people act like fools? Well, that's because right after the love and belonging needs, you move into your esteem needs. The esteem needs are two-sided. It is respect for self and it is respect for others. And you cannot do that in an atmosphere of lies. So this is where most Americans fail. And what I found when I was interviewing my clients, they had their secret proclivities, their secret lives.
Truths.
That their wives didn't know about, that their friends would never know about because they were ashamed, especially the cross-dressers. The cross-dressers, a lot of them were businessmen who traveled, and they would take a separate suitcase of dresses and dress up in their hotel rooms when they were all by themselves and just sit there in a dress. But, you know, and never, ever tell anyone. So I realized they were stuck in these closets of fear and shame. And what was holding them inside those closets of fear and shame? Judgment. Judgment. And that's why Christ tells us not to judge.
Right.
And so I call judgment and judgers terrorists in a world of people that want to self-actualize. We are born to self-actualize, and that's the step right above the esteem needs. It is the pinnacle on the pyramid. And in the characteristics of a self-actualized person is someone who, you know, isn't controlled by fear. You know, they march to their own drummer. They're unapologetic, but they love and embrace everyone. And it's basically a very libertarian way of living.
It's something we've talked about a lot here recently.
Oh, you're talking about self-actualization?
Not judging. But no, I think in that it is. It's it. You know, you can't be. You can't mislead people. You can't. You can't judge people.
No.
You can't make people feel. I think this is where social conservatives go wrong. Many of the people that are judging people publicly are misleading everyone in their lives, and that is the quickest way to break down a relationship.
It absolutely is. Yeah. You're having a fake relationship with people if right. you're in a marriage or a friendship or anything, and there are lies between you.
Well, I'm talking about on a political level. So, I think on
there's lies there.
It
is one entire lie. Right.
So I think on a political level, you know, we as a country have looked at the relationship that we have with politician, this archetype, and we feel misled, we feel lied to, we feel that they don't have our best interest at heart, they have their own interest at heart, they're selfish, and that we just don't feel safe with them in control of our lives.
Really good analysis, and it's 100% accurate. And I just want to restate something once again, that judgers are terrorists in a world of people wanting to self-actualize, needing to self-actualize. That's our human destiny. And the mission that I was given while I was a dominatrix, and I received the mission in 2002, and I write the crazy story about how the mission was revealed to me through this supernatural experience that I'm not going to recount here.
Yeah.
You got to read the book if you want to know the supernatural thing that happened in the dungeon and how I was given my mission. But the mission was to advance the self-actualization of the individual via the education, exploration, and practice of realistic lifestyle DS, or dominance and submission. And while I don't work in the kink world anymore, and I don't practice dominance and submission in that way anymore, dominance and submission permeates every relationship on earth. I'm very, very sub at work. You know, depending on my role, I can be dom or sub. I enjoy both roles, actually. Sometimes it's a lot of work to be
your
the dom all the time.
Your experience has probably provided you an ability to go back and forth between those roles that no one would ever. I mean, it'd be hard to find any other experience that would lead to that ability to jump between the dominant and the submissive role in a corporate environment, which would be hugely beneficial in so
right.
many ways.
And be conscious any time of what role you're in.
It would be completely unaware.
Yeah.
And you have that ability to be self-aware and say, what's the right move here?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And also, in very short periods of time, you can go back and forth from dom and sub. And there are also people who have relationships. They're called switches, who switch in their relationship back and forth between dom and sub. And they do so consciously.
Well, I think it all comes down, again, libertarians are very individualistic creatures. A friend recently explained objectivism to me in a very real way. And, you know, that we look out for our self-interest, that no one else can look out for your self-interest like you can. And so you have to know your core values, your core principles, and you have to exercise those and negotiate those with other people. But at your core, you have to stay an individual and you have to stay true to who you are and work towards self-actualization. So,
right. If you're not true to who you are not working through your esteem needs.
Right.
The paradox seems to be that you have to reject acceptance in order to get to self-actualization, because you have to reject anyone else's opinion except your own in the stage of social acceptance in order to leap up to the top level. Is that right?
I don't know. We could think about that.
No, not necessarily, because as a former recovering people pleaser myself,
there's a meme
now
in there somewhere.
He's a social assassin.
Yeah, people pleasing meme in there.
You know, as someone who's lived their life trying to make everyone as happy as they possibly can be, sometimes to the detriment of myself, I've come to a place where I realize that I can't get to that level if I am connecting myself to...
Creating your own environment.
So I need to surround myself with people who have my best interest at heart. You know, people like you. Greg has been an invaluable friend as I've gone through my divorce with advice and
telling him to leave and keeping women out of his life.
So
and memes,
yeah,
embarrassing ones,
and just looking out for my best interest and making sure that you know that I am. He knows me. He understands me. He understands the individual that is Chris Spangle and the value that that person has. And this is what you should and should not accept for yourself. And so but you lose friends, you know. And I've lost a couple recently where, you know, the bent was to get me to live their life. It was to get me to live in the way that they want, and would use bullying tactics to get what they wanted. And so you've got to let that go. So it isn't a paradox to me. It is about choosing the healthiest relationships for yourself.
That's a good point.
And so I don't think that you have to... there are certainly always going to be people in your life who have, you know, a problem with your dominatrix business. But at the
end... It's actually surprisingly few anymore. I mean, it used to be kind of a bigger deal than it is now. It's extraordinary to me that I am sitting and living the life that I am today, having done that, and how I was able to take all of that and kind of turn it into something meaningful, and become an author and get a publisher like the Indianapolis Business Journal. I mean, seriously, the Indianapolis Business Journal published my book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they do Mitch Daniels books.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
right.
This isn't Amazon self-publishing.
No, this isn't Amazon self-publishing. I mean, these are, and that's why the book is so beautifully crafted, is because it was, you know, they steered me through the whole ordeal. And it is very, very difficult to write a book that reads well with the reader in focus. And it's really expensive to employ the right, you know, literary help. Literary consultant is who I hired to help, you know, guide me through that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad that I got that experience. And I cannot wait to write my next book.
Yeah. So we've kind of talked about the formation of Melissa and the BDSM stuff and how that all... in surprisingly, our most spiritual episode yet.
No kidding.
And you know,
is it? Yes.
And I was.
I'm on a mission from God.
I will say the funniest part is that the Christian listeners that we have that have written me after Aunt Donna will look at the BDSM stuff and go, oh, I'm not listening to that. But it actually has been very good, Melissa, so far.
The message is exactly spot on.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
I'm a Christian.
Let's get into the political activism. So. You're running a perfectly legal business. You are doing nothing wrong. You are not prostituting yourself. You are not engaging in any illegal activity.
I had a freaky deaky art role play business.
Right.
And I was a tutor. Allowable home-based businesses. Mm-hmm. You can be an artist and you can be an educator in your home. There are rules about, you know, how many clients you can have a week or how many cars basically can be parked around or whatever, and how much of your dwelling can be used for business. I mean, your whole house can't be
written off.
Yeah. Oh, and I never wrote off space because I was super paranoid that, you know, that you know, I'd get an audit or something weird for that. So I've never written off like space as a tax deduction.
Right.
I just always took just legitimate, you know, things I had to buy to do business.
So so how does it all start to erode? Talk about where, you know, so you get caught up in sweeps week, you become a news story.
It was a vice detective?
Well, there's two basic outings in the media. The first happened in 2003. And then, you know, I was used for ratings for Sweeps Week. And I like to joke now because I'm an advertising, you know, account executive. And I like to joke now that, you know, Channel 6 used me for ad revenues and they never paid me a commission. I still think I need to be paid.
Yeah. At least like insider access to their website or something like that.
Well, I guess I sort of have Abdul now. I mean, we're friends, but.
is he affiliated with them?
Yeah. He's on Channel 6.
Oh, just to go on and.
Yeah. He's just, gotcha. He has like a little segment he does. But, and then, so that I, you know, I kind of went away from Dominatrix for 6 months, did some home renovations, and then, you know, turned the you know, put the turned it back on again. And then I practiced the following year. I threw a huge art event. I had this dream. I'm like, oh, I wonder if I could advance cultural tourism in Indy, because the Mayor Peterson was all about cultural tourism. And I'm like, you know, there's this pent up demand for this, you know, erotic art event. A friend of mine had founded it. He was, you know, part of one of the salons, the art salons in town, and he couldn't do its 10th anniversary. He came to me with the project. He's like, just produce it bigger and better than ever. It's the 10th anniversary. I can't do it. I'm married. I have this business. I have kids. I just can't do this. And he's like, you can do it. And I'm like, well, I've never done an event like that before. He's like, you know, he's looking around at my house and everything, and he's like, you can do this.
You'll be all right.
Yeah. And I'd been a caterer, and I'd done parties and events. So I'm like, all right, I'll take it on. And so my vision for the event, which all came true, was that I would put the kink community and the arts community together at Halloween for a big erotic art event. And I rented Fletcher Point in Fountain Square, which was this huge Gothic church. It was three
Beautiful.
Levels. We put 1,000 people in that venue.
Whoa.
I did that event with $100 out of pocket. I got so much interest in the project that I would get people to buy VIP advanced sale tickets. And as they would buy tickets, I would pay for all the things I needed to pay for in advance. So all I had to do was pay the original $100 deposit for the venue out of pocket. And like, God just gave me all the money I needed to make everything happen. All the whole community came together and helped with the project. I found a fabulous art curator. She hung the show from wire in a National Historic Landmark salon style in 24 hours. We got rave reviews in the media, and I made a little money on the show. And it was a huge, huge success.
So you threw an art and erotic combined party on Halloween, All Hallows Eve, inside a church.
Inside a church.
This is the...
That, of the Christian listeners that he was referring to earlier, that just... goodbye, guys.
I will tell you, this is the...
Well, it was an event venue
time.
Yeah.
I understand.
This is a quintessential Melissa story, because it pulls together all the parts of Melissa doing
That's
things
great.
On a shoestring budget.
It, very she's representative.
Fantastic organizer of events. So...
It was so fun. And then after that, I was so tired. So this is, you know, this is Halloween 04. I'm really tired. But at the event, I announced that there's going to be a kinky retail boutique in town next. So that was my project after, you know, the erotic arts ball. So I tell everybody I'm going to do this retail event or this retail shop. Of course, I have no idea how I'm going to pull that off. But you know me, I'll just say it and then go do it. And so I ended up getting space in Chatham Arch. And my landlord was Larry Jones. Now, Larry Jones does the Murphy Arts Building. That's his. And now the new Circle City Industrial Center, that he's a real estate developer doing that. He's in my book. He's Uncle Barry. So if there's any artsy people out there listening, Uncle Barry or Uncle Larry Jones. But in my book, I call him Uncle Barry. He's in the book. And anyway, so that's when the trouble started. So we were located in an art building with studios and an art gallery. It's where the old Lamp art gallery was in Chatham Arch. And it was across the street from this daycare. Well, I was real low key. I had no storefront. You had to know I was there. You had to buzz a buzzer to get in. And then I would look you over and decide if you could come in my shop or not.
It sounds like a riffra nightmare.
It was all tightly controlled. And, you know, I was selling, I knew the rules for adult retail, and I did not want to be an adult retail shop because I knew I couldn't be located where I was. But I could be like a novelty store, like Spencer's in the Mall. Okay? Spencer's in the Mall has kids running through that all day long, don't they?
Yeah.
Don't they have like penis toys?
Oh yeah,
and stuff
sword fights all day long.
Well,
Peffers and I went over there after the last podcast and had a sword fight.
Okay. okay. So I'm like, okay, I knew the laws backwards and forwards. I didn't violate anything. I was really low-key and undercover. But here's what happened. The gallery in the front of the building moved out. Larry had to bring in a tenant. So there was this theater troupe that needed a short-term space to rent, and the gallery was perfect for it. They were on a shoestring. He made it affordable. Well, they didn't have a big budget, so to cover up the windows, they used black plastic, like black trash bags.
Yeah, that's a quick way to get a
inspector. Well, at the same time, I'm running little ads in Nuvo about my retail shop, and the daycare lady across the street sees black plastic ad, and she freaks out.
Yeah. Right.
Larry gets involved, you know, and he's like, look, there's nothing to worry about. Nobody's violating any laws here or whatever. So then I kind of have to let the neighborhood in and look at my space. But there was this guy next door.
There's always a guy next door.
Who was the neighborhood association president.
Of course. Did he have a mustache, too?
He was also a lawyer. But yeah, evidently not a very good one, because he was well into his 40s and he hadn't made partner yet. So anyway, he did not like my landlord, because my landlord was going to tear the building down and put and build an apartment building there, which it is now there. He's got retail space on the bottom and apartments up top, and it's a beautiful building. It's all complete now. But at the time, this neighbor did not want that to happen, and he was in charge of the neighborhood association. So he decided to use me as a pawn to get to his arch enemy that was going to tear down the building, and I got caught in the middle of this political thing that I knew nothing about. I thought that Larry would be able to handle it, and he did too, but it blew up. They had this big neighborhood association meeting, and I was the subject of it. And most of the people there were kind of like, leave her alone. We've been through it. It's actually kind of, I mean, it is Mass Avenue Arts District, okay? It should be okay down there. But no, there was just enough of them that, you know, they go through their Robert's rules. And do I have a second about sending a letter to the mayor's office? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the Chatham Arch Neighborhood Association sent a letter to the mayor's office. So I think what happened is they get the letter. The mayor's office goes, ooh, this is interesting. Mayor Peterson probably had some advisors around him that are like, how could we spin this into political gold?
We love family values. Let's keep them out of our neighborhood. Right. Yeah.
And that's how I think it all happened. The mayor got bad advice. The next thing I know, I did a session with a vice cop. And that's the first chapter of my book. It is available free online at spankingcityhall.com. And if you want to read about what I did to the vice cop and how I turned the tables on him when he relentlessly sexually harassed me at my place of business. Oh, and libertarians, you'll like this. Okay, I go through sexual harassment training at work, and this is the rule.
Mm-hmm.
You go up, we call it elevator eyes. You go up and go, hey, baby, you're looking pretty hot today. And you're like,
thank you.
I know.
I know, yeah. Would you like me to bend over and get this quarter?
Well, or if you're a woman, you may go, you're kind of creepy. Stop doing that.
Thank you for looking at Greg when you said that.
I know.
And if he continues to do it one more time, then after you've said, no, I don't like these advances, then you are to go and report it to HR, and then it becomes an HR issue that could lead up to termination. And that's how sexual harassment is done in every professional employment environment.
Right.
However, the government can send someone into your place of business with the sole purpose of sexually harassing you, use taxpayer money to pay him to sexually harass you, or funds to do it. And it's just absolutely mind blowing. So I told this man, no less than 25, 30 times the rules, but he kept insisting and he wanted to learn.
And you didn't know up front.
No, I didn't know that he was a vice cop.
That's the thing.
The mustache and the aviators didn't throw you off.
He had like tattoos and stuff. And we give his physical description in the book. But if you want to learn what I did to this vice cop who would not stop sexually harassing me, go right now to Spanking City Hall. If you go under, I think the link is called excerpts, the entire first chapter's there. And you can read for yourself, but it was actually quite fun.
Yeah, the book is very well written, very well done. And if you buy a copy, it is beautifully done. And the City Hall here in Indianapolis has a large, tall center. And on either side of the tall portion, there are two short, stubby, ball-like things. So it's a very phallic looking building. So and then on the other side of town is the state capitol, and that looks like a giant boob. So so you'll have to check it out.
It's erotic architecture. Oh, and my dungeon is actually in a book that's published in France by an art sociologist from Sorbonne. And the book is on erotic architecture, and my dungeon is in that book.
Now, do you still live in that home?
Yes, it's the only house I've ever lived in. I mean, it's my first house, and I still live there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a great house.
Yeah, and Chris has been there. You can come over
sometime, too.
So
you've lived there all those years, and that was one question I wanted to ask. So you embraced this head-on. You leaned into the situation and said, I'm not going to hide it and let it control me or not control the narrative. But you had known most of these neighbors for, I'm guessing, quite an extended period of time.
Yeah, I still have all the same neighbors. They're really nice to me, and they like me, and we all get along in peace and harmony and tolerance, just like you're supposed to do.
So how did that, when you decided to do this full-time, how did that process, or what did it look like when you decided to inform them? Did you have like a party and then say, guys, I want to talk to you about something? Or did you go to like a neighborhood association meeting? Or did you just, send out flyers?
I did not flyer my neighborhood.
I'm kidding.
But I mean, people knew. There was an older woman next door who had trouble getting around. And she had
lived, Donna.
Aunt Donna.
Yeah, Aunt Donna. And I mean, I think she's probably lived in that house for 35 years now. But anyway, at the time, you know, her yard mowing was kind of sporadic, and I knew she needed help. Well, I was getting my yard mowed for free by my submissive, so I'd be like, they'd be like, oh, we love serving women, all women. I just live to serve women, miss. And I'm like, great. Then you won't mind mowing my neighbor's grass because she's a woman and she needs help. And they would just kind of roll their eyes. Yes, miss. And they would go. And so I would make sure her yard was mowed every week.
That's great.
And then one of my other neighbors, he actually was kind of around when I was building the dungeon because we were friends. I think we had dated for a minute before I became a dominatrix. And he lent me a masonry drill and, you know, kind of gave me some construction-y advice when I was building the dungeon. So he knew all about it. In fact, he was one of the first people that saw it when it was finished.
So tell us about the press conference. Let's fast forward to the press conference.
Oh, Mayor Bart Peterson's press conference.
So the cop has come. The vice detective has come.
So 6 weeks after the sexual harassment session with the vice cop, which is chapter one of my book, 6 weeks later, I get a knock at the door. It's old Jack Reinhardt of Channel 6 News again, standing at my door, but this time with a lawsuit in his hand.
Really?
A city had filed a lawsuit. See, they couldn't get me for sexual harassment, so they're like, we'll just file a zoning lawsuit against her. So here's the city of Indianapolis telling me what my free speech and my art can or cannot be. Mm-mm. But I didn't understand, you know, I was very shell-shocked at the time. I found out that there was going to be this press conference. I was tipped off. I was not supposed to know about that press conference. And the smartest thing I did was make the decision not to cower in fear and shame, but to put on my best Armani cashmere coat and a hat and walk down there and confront them. And that's exactly what I did. And that drama of the press conference. Oh, and it was no little press conference. Let's make this clear. There was a podium. There was the mayor. There was the public safety director. There were city attorneys. There was every muckety muck at City Hall that the mayor could get down there. outdoor press conference, lots of news trucks. There might as well have been helicopters flying overhead.
All of that
getting
is,
aerials.
Yeah, and all of that is very rare. I mean, they put the full court press to get the press there, to get everybody mobilized, to get there, schedule it. I mean, that would have been
about free hot sandwiches to just fill the chairs.
Basically, yeah. There were probably
100, 150 people at that press conference. And so the mayor's up there talking about, you know, what's in the lawsuit and why they're filing it. Of course, he has no idea I'm standing there in the audience with the gaggle of reporters. And because, you know, I had an online website, I kind of thought of myself as citizen media anyway. And so he calls on people to ask questions. And I'm like, great. So I raise my hand and he calls on me. He calls on me and I said, so, do any of her businesses meet the legal definition of adult? And he was like, someone nudged him and said, that's her. And he looked at me and then he said, we're only taking questions from the press.
Right.
Yeah, it was so insulting. I mean, I couldn't even confront my accuser in public. And so that's when the media kind of caught wind that something dirty was at play here. And then a member of the media asked the same question. And the mayor couldn't answer it, so he turns the microphone over to the city attorney. Now, I do not believe that Terry Kendrick, the city attorney, who also did the violent video game lawsuit that was a dismal failure, but he did not believe that, or I don't believe that she even wanted to do it, but she had to get up there at the microphone, and you know how they are. Well, you know, this isn't what the Historic Preservation Council had in mind when it blah, 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 you know. and the children, and right. You know, the whole thing gets thrown in there, and that's when it was on. And that is the day when I made the decision that, you know, I could either lay down and pay the fine of this civil lawsuit. It's not criminal. It's a civil lawsuit. It carried a fine of $2,500. So I could pay that fine and lay down and let them walk all over me and walk all over freedom in my city and basically be misogynists. Mm. That's what they were. And these were Democrat misogynists, all right?
Indiana Democrat misogynists.
Indiana Democrat misogynists. Ooh, that's a band name.
Yeah, good. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, that's a band name. And I could let them walk all over me or, you know, I could fight. And then I could stand up for my First Amendment freedom and anyone else's.
Yeah. And then so that happened. Now, you did not pay the fine.
No, I did not.
No. What were the repercussions and what did the falling out process look like?
Well, it took me a month to network to the right lawyer. And that lawyer is Mark Small. And he's located in Broad Ripple. And today, Mark Small and I are dear, dear, dear friends.
Yeah, anybody who's listened to episode 91, Mark Small was instrumental in helping our friend Woody find the right civil lawsuit attorneys. So, Mark...
Mark's a mensch.
Yep. Civil Discourse Now is his podcast, if you want to go and check that out.
Yeah, Mark has his own political podcast. And actually, when he was starting that, I helped network him to a lot of conservative types of people to be guests on his show. But anyway, long story short, I hire Mark. The first thing Mark says to me is, you're going to hold your own press conference. And I'm like, uh-uh. And he said, oh, yes, you are. He's like, you can do it. And so I did it. And it was okay. And that's when the fight was on. So shortly after that, Abdul, you know, had me on his show a few times, and Abdul just saw Dominatrix and knew it was ratings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chris Bangle, yeah. His producer, was like, I got to meet this girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. And the thing is, I think that all of you guys were kind of skeptical of me at first, and no one did me any favors except to try to give me a level platform to tell my side. And I will forever be appreciative to Abdul for that. Because nobody else in town was letting me do that. Well, Howie Politics did, and Abdul did, and Nuvo. Oh, Nuvo was always there by right. My side. There was always Nuvo. And
the Indy Star wouldn't let you write an op-ed.
No, I was on the front page of the Indy Star in those days as basically the town whore. Yeah, front right. page. front page of the paper.
The state's largest newspaper for those playing at home.
Yeah. And so anyway, it took 20 months of litigation. I spent maybe $5,000 or $6,000 to litigate against a $2,500 fine. But it was a legal education. And I did get a great education in law and how these things progress for probably a pretty cheap fee.
Yeah.
And so it didn't cost that much. I thought it was worth it. And then, you know, the rest is history. The following year, this takes us into 07. The following year, all through 06, I'm studying City Hall. And you know that story. I'm like, they're not going to win. And I've got to fight this in the media. And if I'm going to be effective, I better learn who's down there, what their names are, who they're related to, their backstories. It's like a soap opera.
Yeah.
You have to learn them all. And then
Indianapolis is the 12th largest city in the nation. And there are, you know, the political crowd in this state and our city is 300 to 500 people. I mean, it's not—it's not a big pool.
It's hard. Yeah,
you get to know people. Everybody kind of knows who you are. I mean, when I was head of the Indiana Libertarian Party, I mean, it was, you just—I would see the same people all the time. They all knew me. I was the Libertarian guy. You know, it's, the media
president, even
president of all libertarians. Mm-hmm. As
great leader.
Who was, I'm trying to think of his name, the older councilman, Democrat, African-American gentleman, introduced me to Joanne Sanders, the council president one time. This is the president of all libertarians.
Chris Spangle.
Oh, which one was that?
I wish I could remember his name. Doc or, we'll figure it out off air. But
it wasn't Paul Bateman, was
no,
it?
No. Older.
Oh.
William something, maybe.
Oh.
You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But yeah. Very funny. And I was like, I do not want that upgrade. I can barely handle executive director.
And after taking this job, I'm not even sure I'm a libertarian and or like libertarians.
And then somehow Greg has made me deer leader. So in 2004, Mitch Daniels is elected and a very reform-minded governor here in Indiana.
Same year I'm throwing the erotic arts ball.
And
in a church.
One of the things that was ridiculous here in Indiana was the inventory tax. So if you had a business, then you would pay taxes on all of your inventory. So imagine
being productive and having goods.
Right. And so the state leadership 10 years ago said, this is kind of stupid. If we're the crossroads of America, we have this longstanding tradition of being a port city for the railroads, and now the interstates all kind of converge in 465 here.
Yeah, the whole focus was on creating a logistics super center.
Exactly, and now that the Panama Canal has been doubled, you know, right outside my window here, they're doubling the size of the interstate outside my backyard. And let me tell you, listeners should be glad for the new concrete walls between us and the interstate, because you can't hear the noise anymore. So they got rid of the inventory tax. So if you had a small business, you'd pay taxes on staplers and office supplies because it was inventory. And so they got rid of that, and all that revenue had to be made up somewhere, because just because you get rid of a tax, it doesn't mean that the government stops spending less. Yeah, they shifted it to property taxes. And so in early 2007, as property tax bills started going out, bills were just sky high, and we're talking
explosion.
House payments went, I mean, what were some of the house payments increases?
Oh, I remember this very well. And that's kind of how I became an activist, was because I was a libertarian and I became a fair tax volunteer, kind of just to have something to do. And I believed in the fair tax, and all I wanted to do was get the fair tax in the media. It was just like this driving ambition in me. And I saw this property tax thing on the blogs where I was studying City Hall, and I saw, you know, I saw the media, the quote unquote real media saying that, oh, it's not going to be any big deal. Don't worry about it, people. They've got it under control, yada, yada. Meanwhile, the bloggers with all this inside intel were going, oh no, Hurricane Katrina's hitting the city and y'all need to look out. Well, it took forever for them to get the reassessments done, what they were completely inept at doing and incapable of doing this on the scale. So they were just basically making up willy-nilly and sending out property tax bills. But before they sent the bills, they posted them all online. And I started just one day, as soon as that link went up and those bills were available, I started I started typing in addresses on my street. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, holy cow, nobody's going to be able to pay this. I mean, there were bills going up $1,000 a month.
Especially the neighborhood you're in.
Gun to your head, and you have to pay me $1,000 every month.
We're taking
forever.
Your home. We're foreclosing on it, and we're going to sell it.
Yeah, for whatever we can get.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what happened. And so I'm like, this is a perfect opportunity to get the fair tax in the media. And I had this crazy idea that we get a posse of bicycle riders to go house to house with the good news of the fair tax, tell them that we had a solution to the problem, and get everybody into the streets at the governor's mansion on the 4th of July. There was only one problem with the plan, that all of my posse volunteers on that Sunday morning backed out with one excuse after another, and I was left standing alone. And this is another example of walking into your fear. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I could really risk looking like an idiot, you know? Like, you know, first of all, would even anybody come? And, you know, what are people going to think of me? All this stuff went through my head. But then I was like, no, I have to see it through. And I am so glad now I did. My life would not be the same had I not made that decision to walk into my fear. My life would be drastically different. You know, I wouldn't be here talking to everyone now. I wouldn't have written a book. I wouldn't understand, you know, these concepts of self-actualization the way that I do today, and cultural activism, which is what we did.
Yeah.
We didn't really do political activism. We ran antics in the media for months.
Right.
To keep our story in the media, and it influenced public opinion so far that we caused an election upset. Mm-hmm. And we put the government somewhat on their knees. We didn't get the solution that we wanted.
They didn't close, unfortunately.
They didn't close. Well, we wanted repeal of property tax altogether. And I do believe had we not pushed so hard for repeal, we wouldn't have gotten a fix as good as we got. But, you know, it basically Governor Daniels, God bless him. I'm never going to say a bad thing about that man, because he treated us with respect and he got that crisis under control. And God help us if we'd had any other governor but Daniels in charge when that nightmare went down.
Mike Pence. Sorry, had something something awful in my throat.
So
he would have looked at you and be like, "How can I use this against gays?"
he might have. Yeah. How can? Well, and actually, Eric Miller, one of the little minions behind the RFRA thing, was there trying to pull the. Because as soon as he saw that I got people in the streets, Eric Miller was on it. He was gathering up his people, and he was using it was gay hate and property tax all rolled right. into one. Remember that?
Yes. It was like Rick Santorum marched right into the streets of Indianapolis.
Oh, it was awful, and it made me insane. And I couldn't get the LGBT community to come out in any kind of mass with that, and I really wanted their help, but. At that time, I didn't know enough of the leadership or really how to orchestrate it, so I kind of failed on that front. But
and every organization picks their battles. You know, they have limited political capital, and they'll only spend it on certain things.
Yeah. The first unofficial non-named, non-titled Tea Party was July 4th, 2007. Andy Horning, a longtime libertarian stalwart. If you don't know Andy, look up Andy Horning. His blog is wedeclare.blogspot.com, I believe. And Andy is a great writer, great videos.
Thinker.
Look him up on YouTube, yeah.
You could call him a constitutional scholar.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
And has run for office here in Indiana. And
every office, really.
Yeah, he has run... he was on Abdul's show, and I don't know what day it was. Maybe it was Memorial Day. And in 2007, and started saying, you know what, the property taxes, we need to do something. Let's get together July 4th outside of the governor's mansion. He managed to get 500 people there. They shut down traffic.
Well, I got the people there.
Well,
Andy came along after he knew that I had done this thing, and he calls me and he's like, do you think at least 100 people will be there?
Yeah.
And I'm like, Andy, I don't know, but I talked to so many people and they all have flyers and I told them all to get on their computers and email everyone they knew and that we had a fix. And I have no idea what to say to them. And if I don't get somebody there that knows what to say,
yeah.
I'm in trouble. So please come and help me. And he's like, so you think at least 100? And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I got at least 100 coming. And I about cried when I saw how many people actually did show up. And
that was at the White River, right?
No, it was at the Governor's
Mansion. And I chose that site, the Governor's Mansion, because it is the symbolic home of Indiana. And it
we
was
paid for it.
Yeah.
My God.
Well, and it's where the governor's supposed to live, or you know, some governors have lived there. And anyway, I just thought it was the perfect location, and I knew that Meridian Street was the main artery headed downtown for the 4th of July ceremonies. And if we caused enough disruption, a whole lot of people would see us. And I knew that it would play well in the media. It was also a perfect location because it's in the center of the Meridian Kessler neighborhood, and it was my neighbors I was gathering. So it, like, for many reasons, it was the perfect location on the perfect date. And but then there was,
well, I mean, like, the average home value in that area has got to, like, right, you know, I'm sure in Meridian Kessler it's what, $400,000. So any percentage increase affects the high end way the hell more than the $150,000, you know, starter home communities. So, like, it was felt huge.
Oh, it was scary.
In the like, you know, just to give an understanding to the listener, like, it was $500 million you saved Marion County taxpayers, correct?
We actually statewide with the fix that's in place, it saves homeowners in their main home. It saves $500 million a year.
Yeah, annually.
Statewide. And so far, the savings is over $3
billion. Yeah.
So we moved.
It isn't like...
We moved. Plucky kids, kind of. We moved $3 billion.
Yeah.
So then from the July 4th event...
let me give you a little background. So, Andy Horning, and this is all these quotes are in the book, and I have, there was audio, and this is how I was able to recreate everything to write the book. There was a gentleman in the crowd that yelled, "We need a tea party." I'm like, what the heck is that? I mean, I knew of the Boston Tea Party, but I was like, tea party? The people want a tea party? Well, remember, I have this experience throwing parties.
Mm-hmm.
I always threw parties. I love parties. I live for parties.
Right.
And I'm like, I am going to throw the people a party, and it's going to be a tea party. And I have no idea what that looks like, but I'll figure out the details. So it was a few days later, we had a fair tax forum at Talbot Street Nightclub. They let us use it. All the media came, and you know, the smart guys like Sean Shepard and Andy Horning, and you may have been there that night. I don't remember. But you all put on a fair tax forum, and my job was to be hostess and hug people. And then after that meeting that night, we were at the Living Room Lounge on Pennsylvania. And we were all sitting around a table, and I'm looking at Sean Shepard, who was the state fair tax director at the time, and I just met him. I'd only known Sean a week at that point. And I'm like, what the heck does a tea party look like? And he's like, well, we could get a giant tea bag, and we could stuff it with property tax assessments. I'm like, well, where do we get a giant tea bag? I'm like, I bet I could get somebody to make one for us. And so we were just like... almost like, you know, Little Women when they decide they want to put on a play or whatever. We just made a homemade event and got the media, and there you go.
You know, that's great, because it's one of those things. The guy that founded LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, once said entrepreneurship or organizing is like jumping off a cliff and figuring out how to build a plane on the way down. And that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. You just,
you know, necessity, you got, you know, it's, you've committed, you're
mm-hmm.
on the way down, you might as well put something on.
Yeah, and if you have good, smart people with integrity around you, and you're all committed to the same goal, you can do anything.
Oh, yeah, you can pull off anything you want to. I mean, you can't guarantee that 50,000 people are going to show up, but you can do something that makes enough change mm-hmm. to move $3 billion in property taxes on a whim at a bar downtown.
Yeah, and so what we did here in Indiana as libertarians was just absolutely extraordinary. The whole thing was libertarian-led, but we were really careful to make sure that people knew that it was nonpartisan. We weren't trying to convert people to be libertarians. We were trying to help fix a problem.
There's a financial incentive for them to participate.
Yeah, there was a financial... We were trying to fix a problem and also force the government to behave better.
Yeah.
You know, it was twofold. And so... I always say, I talk about cultural activism all the time. What we did was cultural activism, not political activism. Political activism does not ever put a politician on his knees. Let's just make this real clear. Ever. Give me one example. But we can cite thousands of examples of cultural activism putting, you know, politicians on their knees. The most current example is the forgiveness in Charleston and all the talk about the Confederate flag. And now all these state governments will not fly the federal flag anymore.
So,
can you imagine if you tried to get that done via political activism?
Right.
Could have never done
law.
It.
Right. Yeah.
Then we have our RFRA here. Oh, and now we have marijuana reform, too, with Bill Levin's church.
But we, just to be clear, we're not saying what Dylann Roof did was cultural activism.
No. Dylann Roof, what he was a catalyst, like a horrible, painful thing, like property tax bills, but way worse.
I just want to be clear that we in no way, shape, or form are supporting what Dylann Roof did.
No, not at all. But what we are supporting is what the people did in response to that.
Right.
Just where there's a crisis and the people come forward with the solution. And when they gather in mass and they're creative about how they do it, and today we have Facebook and Twitter, which are such powerful tools that we did not have back in our day in 07 when we did our activism. But, it will put them on their knees every single time. Look at what happened with Mike Pence and them. They got on their knees.
Yep.
Yeah, they did. And they're about to learn how to get on their knees on marijuana reform, too. Mark my words.
So what ends up happening, and I'll move the story forward a little bit here. So Bart Peterson was the Democratic mayor. He was seeking a third term in 2007, and he was seeking an unknown challenger in Greg Ballard, who was a Marine. And the Republicans just kind of put somebody up because nobody wanted to run. No major campaign was going to be run. Bart Peterson had $3 million in the bank.
Bart had $3 million. Ballard had 50,000 4 months out. So our event was July 4th, and the election was the first week of November. So that's 4 months out. And every single pundit in town told me I was a stupid, naive idiot, and I didn't know what I was doing, little girl. And and let the grown-ups handle this.
The only show that would have Greg Ballard on to talk was Abdul. I was his producer at that time, so I got to play reporter. I got to go out and get myself mixed up in all this. The summer, in the summer months, crime goes up because people are outside more often and everybody gets a little more agitated in the heat. In 2007, there was a bad crime spree, and Bart Peterson had shifted the power of the police from the mayor's office over to the sheriff's office. So he had ceded control over the police and was taking a lot of heat for that, because the police department, in my opinion, was being totally mismanaged by Sheriff Frank Anderson. And look up Sheriff Frank Anderson and the Indianapolis Baptist Temple for more information on his hijinks.
Oh, there's one thing I'd like to add.
Sure.
His nickname was Bling Bling.
Okay.
Remember? Because of all the medals he would wear on his uniform.
Mr. T starter kit.
Basically, a former U.S. Marshal who seized the assets of the Indianapolis Baptist Temple, who refused to pay pay income taxes because they said their offering was a love gift and it was not income. And that church eventually closed down, and they're actually across the street here from me. And Greg Dixon is a great libertarian, and
he is.
Yeah, very...
and a Christian.
Yep. Well, obviously, as a pastor.
Right.
Associate?
Stop it. So, crime gets out of control, and Bart Peterson's solution is to raise taxes 65%. to exercise what the state of Indiana had given to every county, because we have something here called home rule, which means your home doesn't rule. The state general assembly, basically, if you want something like a small town in southern Indiana wanted to file bankruptcy in 2011, I think, and the state of Indiana would not pass a law in the general assembly allowing them to file for bankruptcy. So the state had allowed an increase in the COIT tax, the county optional income tax. And so Bart Peterson, being head of the Marion County and Indianapolis, which was combined under Dick Lugar, they decided to exercise the COIT tax and increase income taxes by 0.65%. And his spin when this started taking place in August, September, was that he was a great leader, deserved a third term, because he was willing to raise taxes for public safety in the middle of a campaign. And what kind of sane, rational politician does that?
A Democrat.
But we knew on July 4th that Peterson was gunning for that county option income tax.
Yes.
Because it was told to the crowd, you know, and Andy Horning said, you not only need to be on this property tax, but you also need to be pointed down at City Hall on this county option income tax. And I knew about that. And I'm like, oh, there's my angle.
Yeah.
There's my angle to get Peterson for what he did to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know that that sounds vindictive, but,
well,
you know.
No, so, turnabout's fair play. You right. got to find all, your what, leverage points.
All yeah. fairs in politics.
Yeah.
Are,
yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Good, decent people just get screwed, Melissa. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I was decent about how I did it. I didn't, like, violate any laws, or I didn't do anything unethical. All I did was just put a whole lot of angry people, pointed them at him, and pointed out what he was doing. That's all we did.
Yeah.
In the media, with lots of antics surrounding
and,
it.
And Peterson, so between the crime and the COIT increase and the property tax, everybody just associated their state property taxes and assessors. I mean, the mayor has nothing to do with property taxes in the city of Indianapolis. But because,
not a thing.
No, but because he was raising taxes, he became the poster boy for the problem. You know, and Greg Ballard,
because we directed it that way.
Yeah, but, and Greg know. Ballard never never really started to get traction. The Marion County Republicans didn't even start helping Greg Ballard until 2 weeks before the election, when poll results came in and they were like, oh, this guy could win. We need to get our meat hooks in him.
Who is he?
Yeah.
Who is he?
Does anybody know him?
Somebody throw him a fundraiser real fast.
You would not believe how accurate that is.
Yeah. Well, he did get that fundraiser at Barnes and Thornburg.
And so I have nothing bad to say about Greg Ballard. I think he's a great man.
I like Greg Ballard, too. And I was very happy to see him as the Grand Marshal in the Indy Pride Parade last week.
Yeah, I have.
Now he's no longer Republican.
As a libertarian, I have some issues with some of the things he's done as mayor, but as a man, he's a good man.
I think so, too.
So Peterson is... you know, there was one scene that was interesting. We managed to, so a little group of us formed and decided to start organizing events, and kind of, you know, I helped funnel people to Melissa. Melissa was the main organizer of everything. You know, being at the
And you were so inspiring too when you gave us
Tell me more.
Oh, you were, dear leader. You were so
toss in
inspiring.
A good looking, and you're going to be his favorite guest host ever.
Oh, I don't know. When
hey.
You were
handsome,
like,
sorry.
Yeah. Oh, and so sweet.
Look at this tie dye and this hair. Mm-hmm. How can you resist?
You weren't wearing tie dye back then.
No, not yet. I had not been
indoctrinated
by Rupert.
Yeah.
But so we had a meeting, and we became the Justice League, and formed a little group of political assassins who started. Organizing events and helped push the local narrative through blogs, through social media, through just raw activism.
Getting the media, getting mainstream media to show up and...
Yep.
And it, because we were doing such crazy things all the time.
Yeah.
That was the thing. And the my whole strategy that I laid out to everyone when we pulled together the inner core of activists who, and we called ourselves the Justice League, and Chris kind of coined that to us, and it made me feel so good when you said that. It really did. And But the whole strategy was, okay, we don't just use one idea. We take every single person's idea and we use all of them, and we think of every idea as a weapon, and the target is the government thieves. I even drew this out as a little map, but we had the government thieves in the middle, and every single one of our weapons was pointed at them, and we would fire them in rapid fire succession. And my goal was to never give Mayor Peterson a moment's peace to recover from the last hit we just got him with.
It's really guerrilla warfare tactics, dude. Yeah. Is what it is.
We're talking about
pummeling him into submission.
We're talking about a group of about 10 to 15 people organizing via email from different backgrounds, from black ministers who can mobilize that group to the young radio producer who, you know, can influence his boss into talking about certain things.
Thank you so much.
He's pulling the strings on his boss.
The puppet master, our dear leader.
To the, the uptight, starchy lawyer, Mark Rutherford.
Mark's not uptight.
Columbia crowd. I mean, we tried to hit every different segment. And
all the seniors in the Meridian Kessler neighborhood.
But we're talking about a group of people who were able to mobilize less than 50 people at all these events and every press conference the mayor had, and, you know, had signs, and there was creative flair and there was coordination amongst us. You wouldn't believe how effective it is to have 5 to 10 people email a local reporter and say, hey, this event is taking place. You need to be there. Because nobody ever contacts a local official. Nobody ever contacts the local media. They do, but it's like, your story sucked and I hate you.
Here's what I would have done, and this is what you should do in the future.
Right. Yeah. But when you start to get like a dozen people emailing a reporter or a news director, they go, oh, maybe there's something to the story. Repeatedly. Not making yourself like a nuisance, but making yourself persistent and a presence. And so over time, the drumbeat started to really make it look like we were much bigger than we were. And it was definitely strategically placed drums around the hill. So in the valley, you're about to get custard. And that definitely happened to Peterson. Peterson lost to Greg Ballard.
Can we talk about how Peterson's demeanor, though, like the last couple weeks, month before the election?
He started to lose it. And so he started, you know, one incident.
He was so paranoid.
Yeah, incident. He was presenting his budget to the city council. And it was August. It was hot. It was so hot outside.
It was 98.
And, I get in there and I notice that the entire room is like a city council meeting in the city chambers is a quarter full, maybe. I mean, it's the people who have to go that go. I walk in and this budget meeting is packed. There is standing room only. It is every city employee was mandated to go to this meeting to keep all of the citizens out. And the citizens were outside in the 98-degree heat. And because the chamber was packed, they locked the doors downstairs and were not allowing anybody into the building. So then people started, like, having heat stroke outside. And Peterson...
Bart Peterson killed a man today.
Right. which is... And so I noticed the mayor, like, go...
Glad that didn't happen. Like, glad that didn't happen.
He's like, the standing room only outside of the chamber, standing room only outside the door. What do you mean you're locking people outside of the building? Like, this is a government building. Let them in. So while he packed the chambers, to his credit, he did let the activists who were outside in the heat, I mean, probably a couple hundred people, to give you the amount. I mean, there were 1,000 people at this meeting. Over a budget.
That doesn't happen in Washington, D.C.
Ballard's
Paul Ryan.
A budget being presented with blank pages. Remember that part?
Oh.
The budget meeting for Greg Ballard's first year had maybe 20 people at it. And
it was well attended.
Right. Yeah. Well attended. So... excuse me. So he lets everybody in, and there's chanting through the whole meeting. It was just this crazy scene. He's getting like what few people managed to get themselves in, started booing him. Ballard, during public comment, gives his response, and Ballard in public comment was able to give like a 5-minute rebuttal. So I'm walking out, and here's how I remember this. I'm walking out with a reporter from a local Fox affiliate. Nothing to do with Fox News. This is just the local
Fox 59
Tribune owned. And she was cute, and I was trying to hit on her. I had not met yet my...
How old were you then, 22?
I was like 23. So the more things stay
the Do you remember
same.
The affiliate's name?
I don't remember her because she was... So she and I are walking out, and I'm like, hey there, hi.
I'm Chris Bangle. I'm the producer for Abdul.
Right. And, and she's like, oh, you're the producer for the lowest morning rated morning show in town on an AM signal. Good for you, loser. I have more people listening to this podcast right now than listen to that radio show. I'm
By double?
By three times.
Yeah, three times.
Three times.
She had no idea he was... Yeah. She had no idea that you were going to become the president of the Libertarians.
All Libertarians. So she and I
if
are walking
If she had only
out.
Known.
Yeah, if she had only known.
And so, and Fox hires cute reporters, too.
They're really pretty girls. Kristen they're the Kane. Best. They're the best looking reporters.
In, Easily, yes.
Yeah, I agree.
So she and I are walking out, and I'm like, yeah, so that was pretty crazy, right? And she's like, yeah, that was really crazy. She's like, so I have to go crunch tape, and we're going to send it back, and we're going to air Peterson. I said, oh, okay. Now, knowing Ballard has never been on any local TV station, and he's the challenger, the Republican, I wanted to see what she'd say. So I said, so how much of Ballard's rebuttal are you going to use? And she sighs, and she goes, ugh, nothing. And I said, what? She goes, oh, well, my editor's decided that since he's not spending campaign ad dollars with us, we're not going to give him free advertisement. I said, you realize you're in the public service business, and he is the challenger, and it isn't a matter of free advertising, it's public information. And she goes, you're arguing with the wrong pay grade. And the reporter was gone within a month because she was so disgusted by it.
God bless her.
But they did air him.
Now, listen, I can only tell you what she told me, and I remember watching the newscast, and they did not air Greg Ballard that
night.
They
did not. Okay, I don't recall that, but I do know that they, you know, we were locked out, and, it, you know, you the whole city saw our mayor lock out all of these citizens. And
trying to fry you guys on public streets that you pay
right.
for.
Yeah. And
my roads.
And I think that there were a couple nails in his coffin. That was a big one. Another one was, you know, when we did the Breakfast at Bart's protest at his house on a Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m. And we...
did you really?
Oh, yeah.
You went to his private residence?
Yes, in Royal Pines. And we had...
I love that golf course.
We had 10 or 12 activists there. And I knew that we couldn't get media probably to show up for 10 or 12 activists, so I had to be kind of sly. Anyway, and I play it out in my book. You can read it if you want to know how I got them there. But we ended up getting all the media there for 12 activists. And the reason we went is because he aired these arrogant commercials where he's sitting at his, you know, breakfast nook table with the sappy music playing, talking about how he feels the pain of the property tax protesters. And you know, it was just so, like, and here he's raising this tax, so that's where we had to go to his house and confront him because he wouldn't confront us anywhere else or he wouldn't let us talk to him. Well, Mayor Peterson blew it that day because he could have, instead of not coming out of the house, he could have put a bathrobe on and walked out with a pot of coffee and be like, you guys hungry? Come on in and have some breakfast and let's talk. Had Mayor Peterson made that move, he would have won the election. Yeah. I am absolutely convinced of it, and we would have looked like idiots.
Well, that was sort of the... You can always tell the measure of a man by the way they treat somebody's producer. so I could tell...
How are you treated?
Yeah. You know, Peterson would come in and big time the station and command the green room, what little green room we had. And
they had one at WXNT?
Exactly.
I waited in the hall.
Right. And so...
That was the green room.
Yeah.
Okay.
you know, I think I may have met him once or twice, but, you know, the difference is Greg Ballard would come in and ask how it was. Mitch Daniels, the last time I saw Mitch Daniels, it was Abdul's final show. Mitch was the sitting governor at the time, showed up. I had been gone a year from WXNT, and I walk out. I had met Mitch a couple times, but never in the capacity of Abdul's producer, just as like, you know, a handshake and a greeting line with 1,000 other people. And, you know, I walk out and Mitch goes, "Chris, hey, how are you doing?" There's absolutely zero reason that Mitch Daniels should have any clue who I am or what my name is.
Well, he probably listens to this show.
He did, yeah. He once joked, and we had an aligner that his dog in the morning knew only two voices, Mitch's and Abdul's. So yeah, he listened. But Peterson kind of struck me, and this may not be a fair representation of him, just based, you know, so I want to be fair, of course. But he just never struck me as an overly... He wasn't concerned with people or things, and he had kind of an aloofness, and I don't think it served him well in that period. He may be totally different now.
What is he doing now, by the way?
I think like Goldsmith and like the other mayors, you know, went on to teach at like Harvard, and you know, he's
a lobbyist.
Yeah,
Eli
he's a lobbyist. Eli Lilly, yeah.
Because like Dick Lugar was the one that really springboarded out of that. The last right. Indianapolis mayor that springboarded up onto the national stage, and I always thought Goldsmith would, and he hasn't.
Well, Goldsmith went on to be the budget director for Bloomberg in New York City, and then got into a fake tiff with his wife. And then Peterson has been mentioned to run for Senate, but Peterson eventually ended up losing that race to Greg Ballard. Greg Ballard became mayor, and it was quite the victory. I mean, it was really satisfactory.
The voters knew the sitting mayor better than the actual party that he represented.
And we took so much scorn and ridicule during that whole four-month season. You know, we were called every name in the book. I mean, there were people that literally yelled whore at me in the streets. Right. And it was very, very satisfying because they were so smug and they all thought they knew so much more than we did. And what we knew innately, without even having a word to define it, was cultural activism. We innately knew how to do cultural activism. And maybe that's a thing that libertarians just do really well. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, if you look at South Park, Howard Stern, these are very libertarian cultural influences that we grew up with. Libertarians, you know, if you look at the millennial generation, were 40% or one third libertarian?
Yeah, they just don't necessarily realize it.
Versus the boomers who are 1/8 libertarian, you know, and a lot of that is because it is cultural. And I think if you look at the reason that cultural liberalism has caught on is because it's proliferated through the media. And I think Glenn Beck has talked a lot about, you know, if you want conservatives to win in the future, you've got to capture the hearts and minds of people through cultural influences, through art, not through political activism, not through, you know, that's sort of why we, you know, while this is a political podcast, it is wrapped in, you feel like you're sitting around the kitchen table with us. You feel like you're hanging out with your buddies every week, and it's funny, and there's a cast of characters, and we're all your friends, and, you know, because if it were just a lecture between, you know, Greg and I had read prepared statements every week for 115 episodes, it wouldn't be as fun, it wouldn't be as effective, and you wouldn't want to share it with your friends, which you should.
It would be every other libertarian podcast.
Exactly. It'd be just like everything else.
And via...
Two old dudes bitching about the world.
Right. And the libertarians, like, they kind of live their faith, you know? And we're changing the conversation, and that's the first thing you do. And little by little, we're picking off, you know, Democrats and Republicans who are coming our way because we make sense. We make sense. And again, the first step is to change the conversation. And I think we're doing a great job of that. Yeah. And look at Fox Media, Fox, Big Fox Media, Fox News. They've had to put in libertarian content.
Oh, John Stossel is their fastest growing. He's got the fastest growing audience on Fox News. But that doesn't mean that they're still not the majority. So what they do, the political activism, is about getting people to turn out, not creating not changing the narrative, not creating a controversy big enough to get it on apolitical people's radar. But it'll happen. It's not there yet, but it takes that controversy, that self-promotion, public promotion, P.T. Barnum. You know, you have to create the appearance of being larger than you are, and then people have no problem joining the majority.
Right. And I'm going to say something now that's going to be extremely controversial, and you two are probably not going to agree with it. But I think that cultural activism is arguably even more important than voting.
Because it's always been.
I mean, because think always. Of...
You guys agree with that?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, because this is kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, think of how few people vote.
Yeah.
I mean, most people don't...
52% on the best public election year turnout ever.
And even if you put, you know, a social conservative like Mike Pence into office, you know, the few people that showed up to vote that put him into office... we can, you know, because of cultural activism, undo a bad decision.
Well, yeah, because ultimately they're politicians.
And open the door for marijuana reform.
Yeah. one of the goals...
I'm sorry, cannabis reform.
Yeah. I think for libertarians is... It has to be that lifestyle change. It has to be... becoming a libertarian has changed me fundamentally. I mean, it's changed how I view other people and how I treat other people, you know. And for me, libertarianism is the political extension of my Christian faith and treating others
Thank
as
you.
I would like to be treated. You know, I don't want to cause pain and harm, and I want to be a compassionate person. And I don't.
You don't
want
to control people against their consent.
Exactly right. And so I don't want to vote for a president that will drone strike innocent people. I don't want to vote for Lindsey Graham, who will put boots on the ground in other countries. And
although if he drone strikes Congress, like he said he might on his when he announced, yeah.
I would not even advocate for a drone strike against Congress.
Right.
I would not.
I know.
So to me, I think that
of course you were.
Yeah.
The individual as opposed to the collective, you know, the whole Confederate flag bullshit that is going on right now, I don't give two craps about some flag, you know? Like, I really honestly don't. I totally get it. It is a racist symbol. And if somebody wants to walk around with a swastika or a Confederate flag on their truck, good, because then I can see that they're racist fucks.
How about the Union Jack, which has about 800 years more experience with slavery
right.
than the Confederate flag?
You know, or the American flag, which has like 193 million kills on its...
I loved that one meme. It was the American flag and then the Confederate flag. It said one has 100 and XYZ years of supporting slavery. The other had four. Who's
right.
more racist?
Right. You know, and I posted an Onion article on the Facebook page today that's hilarious. Go check it out. But, you know... It just is so crazy that we get drawn into these arguments about a Confederate flag when really that is just so far from the discussion that we ought to be having. Who gives a shit about a flag and what people did 150 years ago? There's a kid who is so desensitized to other human beings that he walked into a church and shot and killed 9 seemingly from every... thing that I've read, amazing human beings.
And he was so
absolutely amazing human
right.
beings who showed him so much kindness
yeah. and compassion
that he thought for a moment about calling it off. And I wrote a blog post at IndianaTeaParty.com, which is where I blog now, even though I'm not at all the stereotype of a Tea Party chick. But anyway, the love and forgiveness and the compassion that came immediately from those victims' family. I mean, they hadn't even had time yet to absorb the shock, and they yeah. were so easy to forgive. And it is exactly the response that was needed to begin to heal this divide in America that is just so gaping and deep And then, you know, a few days later, with all of those people, thousands and thousands that gathered on that bridge, did you see the aerial photography of that?
It was amazing.
Beautiful.
It was absolutely beautiful. And imagine, you know, if our left and our right can come together in America, because we do share a common enemy, and instead of fighting each other, humanity needs to come together. And this is the part about cultural activism that I'd love to take out into, you know, a national media. But if we focus on what we have in common and do those things, because we're all human, and I promise you, regardless of what color we are or what our politics are, because of our humanity, we have more in common than we do our differences. And if we do what we have in common together and focus on that and not our differences, we can unite our country and we can defeat this evil that has seemed to, you know, have overtaken everything. And I'm convinced that the evil's not even very big in number. We're much, much bigger in number. But as long as this country is divided, left versus right, we're not going to be able to accomplish that.
It's just this weird thing that, like, Republicans, in the name of free speech, are, like, sticking up for racism. And I don't know if they don't realize that they're doing it or what are you thinking? Like, just... stop posting about the Confederate flag. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm asking you nicely, stop it, okay? Don't do it anymore, because raise the level of discourse, raise the level of debate. Instead of posting some bullcrap about how you think that the Confederate flag should still be around or how it should be put in a museum or any of that stuff, stop with the distractions, because that is the distraction. Post something about suicide prevention or mental health. That is
post statistics about gun control, about highly developed countries and the countries that have it and don't have it, and how we're not number one when you control for first world countries.
Talk, you know, be sensitive. Know that the culture is against you in terms of gun rights.
Nobody's pro racism. You're never going to find that voter. I mean, you might find that voter if you dig hard enough in Martinsville.
Right.
But you're not going to find enough of them to get any sort of majority.
Exactly right. You know, just choose your hills that you're going to die on a little bit better. You know, and I just feel like there is such a stigma on mental health, especially, that, you know, we create a culture of, especially for males, where a kid like this doesn't feel comfortable expressing any of his feelings, and he's mentally ill, just like people in ISIS are mentally ill. If you drown people alive, if you cut
and
their heads off,
videotape it and use it for
you're mentally ill. The Tsarnaev brothers are mentally ill. They're all terrorists. They're all mentally ill. Whatever. Stop having the argument. Let's start fixing the problem instead of trying to, like, post this thing about a 1992 campaign button with Clinton and Gore having the Confederate flag.
Button.
You look like an idiot. Who gives a shit? Hillary Clinton shouldn't be president because of a campaign button from 1992?
No, it's because her greatest political achievement's marrying Bill.
Right. It just is so... the gotcha politics is just killing us all, and I can't take it anymore. If you can't tell, I have lost my voice. I'm so mad.
Thank God you're not more fired up, or we're right on the verge of another Aunt Donna revolution.
Oh, I'm there. I'm wound up this week,
of
and I'm ready.
The division of this country makes my heart ache.
Yes.
It aches. And, you know, we've got to come together, you know, as humans, as humanity. If we can defeat this evil that is above everything, and I am convinced it is controlling both parties.
Yeah.
This evil is. And defeat that. We know the head of this thing has a whole lot to do with the Federal Reserve bankers. Can we agree on that?
Yeah.
And the control of our money, and they're suppressing things too that I believe is humanity's birthright, like free energy technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's real.
Like cold fusion?
Well, you know, I'm no engineer or physicist or anything, but I mean, you can go out and read about free energy technology. A lot of it's Tesla stuff. And
The electricity and
yeah, I mean and I've talked with all kinds of geeky science guys who are like, yeah, it's real, and you know, these patents get filed, and then the next thing you know, some rich guy comes and says, you know, hey, I'll buy this from you. And if they sell it, they bury it. A lot of these guys end up getting suicided or die or whatever. Right. There's a lot of that going on. But I believe if the people come together, and I know this sounds wacky, but I believe that we can get free energy. Imagine a world where we don't have to work for energy anymore. It's just provided for you.
Yeah.
We could be like,
solves ISIS.
Oh my gosh. All exactly. It solves everything. But remember, at the top of this thing, these guys are making crazy amounts of money by selling us, you know, the whole petrochemical thing.
Right.
So what if we're free from that? Like, how creative could humanity be then? How much of your life do you spend just working to pay for energy?
Right. That's a great point.
That's a lot of faith to place in humanity.
Yeah.
Oh, I have endless faith in humanity. You know why? Because I watch Star Trek.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
I want this world to be like the Enterprise.
A confederation.
All right, so we have to wrap up. We're hitting time here. So at the end of the show, we give you the forum. You can say whatever you'd like, whatever you feel like you didn't get in. Plug yourself. The floor is yours. Get on your soapbox and... rant away and talk about whatever you'd like for just a couple of moments.
Oh, I get to do that?
Yeah, and Greg too. Would you like Greg to go first? Or would you like to go first?
Oh, I like kind of said all of my little talking points, I think. I'd like to hear from Greg. He's the one we've heard the least from.
Well, that's by design.
I just showed up because it was patterned and I thought this is normally when we record. I had no idea you were going to be here at all. No,
That's a joke.
I'm totally joking. You know, he tried to. Yeah.
I did do a little social media on this today.
Yeah.
You did. You were committing some more of your cultural activism.
Absolutely. And a little tiny bit of budget.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to talk about the Supreme Court ruling today, the most controversial one being, of course, King Burwell, where they decided for the first time, well, not really the first time, words do not mean what they say. Words mean in the spirit of how they are passed. So the law clearly states that individuals who are on a state-operated exchange do not qualify for federal subsidy. But because it had to be passed so they could find out what's in it, according to Nancy Pelosi, it was ultimately challenged, made it to the Supreme Court, and because Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy voted with the left of the court, we now can say that if a law says something, that's not exactly what it means. It means what the spirit it was passed in was.
Hey, yeah.
And so we now are at the point where words on paper don't even mean what they say. So what realistic? I mean, this is one of those things where they're saying, oh, well, don't be absurd, don't be ridiculous, blah 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 blah. But you can look at the Bill of Rights and say these are the 10 rights we're guaranteed. Well, 4 is gone.
Right.
Most people don't know 9, 10. You know, they know 1, yeah. They know 2, and 5. But realistically, free speech has already had encumbrances put on it, especially with hate speech and those types of scenarios. But the real question is 2. If words don't mean anything, 2 is the only thing that makes the entire Bill of Rights mean anything.
Right.
So if they interpret that in a way where, well, at the spirit of when they were passing that, they meant you could only have a musket. So every citizen in the United States is entitled to have a musket, but they don't. That doesn't mean they can have bullets. So they can have a vintage musket. So there's different ways of interpreting it, the spirit of the law in which it was passed, that could have serious ramifications. And if 2 goes,
forget
the rest
it.
Of it doesn't matter.
Forget it. Yeah.
Everything's built on 2. 2 is what gives liberty its teeth. So pretty drastic day today. And, we won't feel the ramifications for a very long time. There'll be many challenges and much more case law that will prove to decide the actual precedent set. But today was a rough day for liberty.
Thanks, George Bush and Justice Roberts. You dick.
Yeah, right? He's from Indiana, too. I say we take off, we get rid of his Hoosier status.
Yeah, strip.
You're out of here.
Now, Melissa, where can people find you if people want to contact you, get in touch with you?
Oh, I'm super easy. I am.
Okay.
Facebook, Melissa Hubbard, spelled with a Y, MelySSA. But really, you can just type Dominatrix, Indianapolis, Spanking, Indianapolis. My website's Spanking City Hall. I blog at indianateaparty.com. I have a very active Facebook page, a somewhat active Twitter, and that those are the main areas where, you know, I interact with people. You're welcome to message me if you have questions, you know, if you want to hang out sometime. You know, I go to a lot of events. Come to our Liberty events.
Yeah.
To our Liberty events. They're very fun.
America's Future Foundation, Indianapolis. Look it up on Facebook.
Yeah. We meet at the Liberty Street on Mass Avenue, which is that and the Chatterbox are my favorite joints on the avenue. And I love Liberty Street. We have hors d'oeuvres and free cocktails. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
free drinks, free cocktails, free food.
Free
what more
food.
Do you, free me. What and, more do you need?
And great networking, really fun people to interact with, and always a good program. I mean, they are truly the best Liberty events I've attended in the city.
A lot of eligible bachelors, yes.
Mostly just me. Yeah, no, that is true. Yeah, a lot of single libertarian guys out there.
Ladies, if you want to meet dear leader, these are the events you need to be at. If you want to be in his harem. That is how you get in the inner circle.
Yeah, that is absolutely how to get in inner circle with the Spangle. And to me, he is the Spangle.
That's right.
Right.
And don't you forget it, listeners.
Like the Ohio State University.
Right. All right. Thank you for listening. I used my rant on the Confederate flag, and my voice can't handle another outburst. So with that, I'm going to say thank you, Melissa. This was a great episode.
Yes, thank you for
I
coming
really
on.
Enjoyed it.
Oh, you guys are super fun. This is one of my favorite podcasts I've ever done.
Thank you.
You know, it was really good, but as always,
we promise to do better next time.